Welcome to Bicom's weekly podcast. I'm Bicom CEO James Serene. Today we have a kind of two-part episode. Later on in the podcast, I'll be talking to Alistair Burt, MP, former Foreign Office Minister for Middle East Issues, and Dr. Toby Green about what's been happening with Iran, looking like it's going to be breaking the terms of the Iran nuclear deal and what the options are for the UK and European powers vis-a-vis what's going on with the US and Iran. But before that, I'm very pleased to be joined by Khalid Bendour and Richard Pater from Jerusalem. Hello, gentlemen.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, James.
We're going to be talking a little bit, first of all, about the election campaign. And this is a very strange Israeli election campaign. It sort of seems to be moving in fits and starts. Not much is going on. And then all of a sudden we see a burst of activity. Just to remind our listeners, this is Israel's second election this year. It will take place on the 17th of September because Bibi Netanyahu said he won the election. He drew with seats with the Blue and White Party, but then it turned out he lost the election because he wasn't actually able to pull together a government coalition. And a big part of that was Avigdor Lieberman's decision not to join his government for various reasons. And I think we'll start off just by talking about the latest polls. And we've discussed the polls for many, many months for the first election this year, and always with a very health warning to all our listeners that they have a high margin of error, that they are an early indication of the way people will vote. But what they're telling us right now is something really interesting. And I wanted to discuss that with you both, which is that for the first time, for as long as I can remember, the polls at the moment are showing that Bibi Netanyahu, without Avigdor Lieberman's party, has no route to a 61-seat majority. He simply is not going to get beyond the high 50s because of what is going on with Avigdor Lieberman, and also some interesting things happening on the centre and the left. So first of all, I just wanted to get some thoughts on that. Khaled, do you want to start?
Yes, yeah, so I think the health warning is very much in order. And I'd say something else, that there was a very large poll, in inverted commas, that took place in April. It had 4 million participants rather than the normal 500. And we know what the results were. And I think any discussion needs to be based on how people voted in April and to take things from there. So there have been some changes. Kulanu have joined with Likud. Ehud Barak has entered the fray, but I think more or less this is what the Israeli public think. Now, a smaller voter turnout could affect that, or a larger voter turnout in some sectors, in the Arab sector, that would affect certain things. But more or less, we're looking at what we saw in April plus minus. And as you said, the really interesting thing is that without Lieberman, Netanyahu is currently really struggling to get 61. At the same time, Gantz is nowhere near 61 either, which seems to suggest, again, with a huge health warning, that as things stand, the most likely scenario seems to be what Lieberman wants, which is a national unity government of Likud and Blue and White and Israel Beiteinu. The problem for Netanyahu with that is that Blue and White are going to have consistently said they're refusing to sit with someone under a kind of criminal investigation. So whichever way you look, it doesn't really look great for Netanyahu. But there've been dozens of headlines written about how things are turning bad for Netanyahu, and every time he seems to pull a rabbit out of the hat.
But just a quick question there. Maybe, Richard, you want to come in on this one, which is it something that maybe is formulating as a theory, which is that if we get to a situation where we have a very similar result to April and Avigdor Lieberman is the tiebreaker, is there a point where the Likud turn around to Bibi Netanyahu and say, you know, you were a winner and you were a fantastic winner for us, but you didn't win in April and you haven't won again, and it's time to say goodbye? I mean, is that in any way a potential scenario?
I find that very hard to conceive that's realistic. We've said before, and I think it states it remains true, that the Likud historically have been very loath to reject their leader. I mean, they've only had four leaders in their whole history. We'll talk in a minute probably about the Labour leadership as a comparison. But the Likud show no propensity to get rid of themselves as a leader. What is interesting is perhaps other parties on the right, and you're starting to see this in some of the right-wing media, are saying, you know, that we shouldn't be relying on on Netanyahu, because he is not he cannot be the guarantor of a right-wing political agenda as he has in the past. So that's an interesting move.
So is that going to lead to a sort of large amalgamation of some of these small right-wing parties, and could that potentially score quite highly in the election?
It's theoretically possible. I think generally speaking, again, this might be kind of counterintuitive for a UK audience, but for large parts of Israel, although the Likud is clearly a right-wing party, people see it as part of the centre-right and not part of the extremists. And that's kind of the distinction between Likud's popularity and other right-wing satellite parties, which are kind of clearly far more recognisable as part of either the settler camp or the religious right wing. What's also difficult to extrapolate from the support of the Likud of how much is that of the party and how much is that an endorsement of Netanyahu's personal leadership. I remember, James, you and I sat with Yair Lapid shortly after the elections, and he was kind of, I think, very refreshingly honest to us that it's very difficult for any opposition to win in Israel when the economy is doing so well, and relatively speaking, the security situation is good as well. And I think that's kind of away from these kind of high convoluted theories. The bottom line is that Netanyahu still holds the trust of large swathes of the public.
Mm. I just want to reflect a little bit about the entry into the race of Ehud Barak. And I think there's two things maybe just to mention is number one, that the polling at the moment is unclear what happens with him. Does he win 4 or 6 seats, or does he win no seats at all? And we'll know more as the weeks go on. But one thing is clear is that he's doing something that not many people did in the last election, is he's actually really mounting a very, very vociferous campaign against Netanyahu, potentially landing blows because of their previous relationship that didn't end well. Secondly, he's actually coming up with some quite interesting policy proposals. And one I wanted to just reflect on was that this week he said maybe the root to the entire argument over conscription of ultra-Orthodox men into the army is actually not for them to go into the army, but for them as well as Arab citizens to perform a kind of civil national service, and for that to be their route into their contributions kind of to the country and to help them get into the workforce. I mean, you know, what did we think of that idea? And has that never been proposed before? And if not, you know, why not? And if so, why did it never actually get adopted?
Well, I think it's classic Barak, who's kind of known for his innovative thinking and creative ideas. The main reason why it's never been proposed before is because it runs against the very ethos of the country that it should be a people's army and it should be service for everyone. And by going for some form of national civilian service, it's a cop out and a de jure recognition that this is not the army of the people. I mean, why should you can imagine the predictable response will be of the rest of Israelis is, well, I want my children to serve in civilian service as well. Why should my child serve in the military whilst yours is going just to a national service? On the other side, there is an inherent logic to it, because part of the main problem is the question, what does the army really need in terms of manpower? And the problem with the existing legislation is that when they get the deferral, this is the ultra-Orthodox who go and study in the religious seminaries in the yeshivas, when they get their deferral from the army, it means that they can't enter the workplace either. That's why they're stuck in this trap of going to the learning and not really benefiting the economy either. So Barak's idea has some logic to it, although it has some inherent flaws as well.
Okay, thank you very much, Richard. Thank you very much, Caleb. I think we'll leave that there for now, but we will be returning to this issue and discussing it in great detail in the weeks and months ahead. Just to remind our listeners that BICOM produces regular bulletins, charts, infographics, presentations of the latest polling, which can all be found on our website, on our Twitter feed at Britain Israel. Do keep following that. So we're now going to move from Israeli elections to the situation with Iran this week. And we had a situation where Iran has broken the limit of the JCPOA nuclear deal. It now has been certified by the International Atomic Energy Agency that it has 300 kilograms of enriched uranium, more than 300 kilograms, and it's talking about breaching the limit of enriched uranium at 3.67%. These are two very significant violations of the nuclear deal. And earlier this week, I caught up with Alistair Burt MP, the former Middle East minister, to get his views on what Britain should be doing and what we can do to try and protect the nuclear agreement.
So if I could just ask, we're in a situation now where Iran is potentially breaking the ceiling in the JCPOA nuclear deal, its stockpile of enriched uranium. Europe is saying it's not going to implement sanctions right now. What do you think the options possibly are for the UK and France and Germany?
The best option would be for all parties to return to JCPOA. I cannot for the life of me understand if the United States was concerned about a nuclear-armed Iran, why it broke the JCPOA and started the chain of events which has led us to where we are. We all know the JCPOA didn't cover everything. If it had, it would never have been signed. We all know that Iran is engaged in activities that threaten others, and there must be a way of trying to deal with that. But it should have been based on an agreement that was signed. It was difficult enough for this to be signed. And it's given Iran the opportunity to move away from it, and the justification is that it did not break the agreement, but the United States has. Nothing is improved in the region by Iran breaking the terms of the JCPOA itself and moving to a situation where others may be more at risk. So what we have to do is, I would like to see states return to the JCPOA, and if the United States wants to move on other things, as other states in the region do. It's not just about Iran. It's not just about the United States and Iran. Then we've got to take steps to do so. I noticed recently that Dr. Anwar Gargash of the UAE said the regional players need a voice in this. I think it was a note of caution that this isn't just about the United States and Iran. If anything happens in the region, it'll be the region that's affected. So I think the rhetoric needs to calm down. Each side needs to see how the other is threatened, and we need to work very hard to ensure that the terms of the JCPOA are not breached. But if Iran is going to return to the JCPOA, it is asking that the United States return to it, or something is done to repair the breach.
Did you interpret President Trump's pullback from actually taking military action is in some way a message to Iran to say he doesn't want to do this, and he, because he's got very mixed messages, but he does seem to want to talk. He's sort of giving them a way through. Do you see that at all?
Both sides have given messages over the past year. Remember, this has been a year since the JCPOA was breached. Iran did not rush to break the terms straight away. And when they announced recently that they were going to, you know, in I can't remember, it's 30 days or 60 days, they were sending signals all the time. Trump the same. Trump did not build his presidential campaign on another war in the Middle East. And so I agree. I think both sides talk about not wanting a war, but somebody somewhere is taking the sort of actions that might lead to a confrontation going wrong. And I think the United Kingdom watches this with great concern, and that's why the rhetoric has to be watched, and the individual actions that might trigger something, such as the unattributable actions in the Gulf itself, and the attacks on shipping. Somebody somewhere knows what's happening there. But unless people want to turn those thoughts about we don't want a confrontation into solid action, yes, maybe Trump does want to talk, but on this occasion, he'd be well to work with others instead of just trying to do it himself. Because if he wants an economically prosperous Iran that's not nuclear armed, well, he had a deal that could have done that. Now, for some reason, he broke it, and we've got to find a way back to that.
It seems to me that Iran is saying that it desperately wants the Europeans to do more to try and allow it to trade better with the rest of the world. I mean, Europe seems to be trying very hard with INSTEX, these other mechanisms. You obviously worked on a lot of this when you were in government. Is there actually something that the Europeans can deliver, given how powerful the US sort of muscle is financially? Can the Europeans deliver anything that's going to help Iran?
Any trade or financial mechanism that the E3 provide cannot compete with the amount of trade that in theory is being lost with the United States. And creating a mechanism does not allow a company that is looking as to whether or not it should continue to sell into the US market or to Iran make a decision that says, well, we're going to sell into Iran at the expense of the US. So commercial reasons will dictate that. I think the E3 has tried very hard to find something. Iran understands the goodwill with which it's been done, but it cannot compensate for what Iran is losing, and that gives Iran a sense of that it's signed this agreement and it's lost out heavily. As I say, it needs to understand the other things that it does that everybody appreciates. But the JCPOA was a base given time to deal with those other things. So we're now having to go back to a base that's commonly agreed in order to move forward again.
Mm. Alistair Burt, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I'm joined now by Dr. Toby Green. We are doing a number of interviews from the RUSI BICOM conference on UK Middle East policy. And Dr. Toby Green wrote most of the paper that BICOM produced about UK Middle East policy. He also worked on a recent paper produced by BICOM about Britain's Iran dilemma. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure. Good to be here.
So first of all, I really wanted to pick up sort of where we are this week with the situation where Iran is seemingly violating the terms of the JCPOA nuclear deal. Just this week, they've announced that they have reached the restricted limit and going beyond it of 300 kilograms of enriched uranium. The IAEA has confirmed that that is the case. What do you think, Toby, Iran is trying to do here?
Well, I think it's worth keeping in mind that Iran, up until this point, was keeping within the limits of the deal, and that's attributed to the fact that the deal was very good to Iran. Although it limits Iran's uranium enrichment capabilities for a limited time period, once those limitations elapse, those clauses fall away over 10 to 15 years, then they can basically enrich to the levels that they want. So they were not keen to break the deal. They liked the deal. The problem is, of course, the Americans have taken an approach to addressing the weaknesses of the deal by pulling out of it and putting Iran under maximum economic pressure. And the Europeans are, I think, despite wanting to help Iran to withstand that economic pressure, the European capability to do that is very limited. So I think we're in a position where the Iranians feel that they need to respond, that they, perhaps also for their own domestic politics, and that they're responding on a number of levels to the challenges posed by the United States. We've seen the incidents with the shipping in the Gulf, and this is another dimension of their response, and they're going to ratchet up to show to try and show that the policy that America is pursuing doesn't come without costs, and that they will respond in a way to send a message and try and create some leverage to try and push back on what the Americans are doing.
Where do we go from here? I mean, it seemed to me that when President Trump decided not to launch those military strikes on Iranian soil, and there was reports that they carried out a cyber attack instead or in lieu of, that seemed to me like the US was signaling that they actually want to talk. And that seemed to me that maybe the US was signaling that in the first instance, it would accept some kind of different kind of discussion about the nuclear deal that Trump can present as a victory. And if you look at the other two things that the US has complained about, ballistic missile program and Iran's support of very dangerous organizations in the region, that perhaps they could leave those other two to other for another time. Do you see that? Do you think the US is sort of trying to talk here, or do you think we can just carry on with this escalation?
Well, first of all, it certainly raises some interesting questions about key foreign policy decision making in the Trump administration, that you can decide to launch such a military action and then change your mind at the very last minute. I mean, but Trump has always been pretty clear that he does not want a war in the Middle East. He does not want to see America getting bogged down in another military conflict. He wants to rip up the legacy of his predecessor Obama, which is the deal which he hates. That's always what he's said. Now, of course, he's much more a hawkish national security advisor, has been much more open about his desire for regime change. But to be fair, Trump's rhetoric is in a different direction. It's a horrible deal, as he says, but it's the deal that it seems to be his focal point. He doesn't even seem that concerned about pushing back on Iran's regional policies. He's dead keen to pull US troops out of Syria. He's been announced that policy on numerous occasions and then been rowed back, apparently, by other elements of his administration. So I think from Trump's perspective, if he could produce something that even looks like a result. It looks like he did what he promised and ripped up or renegotiated the Iran nuclear deal, then that would be a win from his perspective. I don't think that that will... it doesn't fully address the concerns of other senior officials in his administration or other actors in the region. But the problem right now is, how do you even get from where we are right now to a meaningful negotiation, given the levels of tension? Is there something going on behind the scenes? Is there a back channel evolving that we can't see? Well, we don't know. But there needs to be some kind of a shift of gears that gets us from this acute crisis to turning American policy into a meaningful negotiating position. Mm.
And just also thinking about the view from Israel on this, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was saying yesterday that, you know, this is Iran putting itself on the path to a nuclear bomb, and also saying that there will be more evidence of Iran's violation of the nuclear deal. And he's referring to a previous situation where, just before President Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal, Israel unveiled this huge archive, which was this spectacular intelligence coup where Israeli Mossad agents had managed to find this Iranian nuclear archive and then deliver it all straight to Israel so it could be examined. Do you think we might see a repeat of something like that? And what do you think the Israeli security establishment is thinking right now about where things are going?
Well, interestingly, the director of Mossad made a speech, public speech, yesterday or the day before, unusual public speech in which she claimed that the Israeli intelligence that had been discovered after it had been fed to the IAEA actually led the IAEA to inspect some sites and to deal with, or I think he said destroy, some nuclear materials that they had not previously addressed. It was an interesting revelation. I think the problem with the Iranian nuclear deal is, in the long run, even if the terms of the deal are kept to, it keeps Iran on the track to, at the very least, nuclear weapons capability. That's not where we're going, I don't think, in the immediate term. You know, breaching this stockpile of 300 kilograms of low enriched enriched uranium, that is not, and that in and of itself is not putting Iran within touching distance of nuclear weapons. That's more a symbolic breach, which is Iran's response to the very acute situation that's happening right now. The route to nuclear weapons capability is the long term problem, and that's what needs to be addressed alongside the acute challenge that we're facing in the Gulf right now.
Toby Green, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.